In the coming week, the first in-person summit of the Quad takes place involving the United States, Japan, India, and Australia. Germans hold general elections that will produce a successor to Angela Merkel, and Japan holds leadership elections. It's September 23rd, 2021, in time for the World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Sheila Smith, sitting in for Jim Lindsay.
Sheila is CFR's John E. Merrow Senior Fellow for Asia-Pacific Studies and an expert on Japanese politics and foreign policy. Sheila, it's especially great to have you on the podcast this week.
It's great to be back, Bob. Thanks.
Well, why don't we kick off the show by talking about the upcoming meeting that's actually generating a special amount of interest, and that's the first in-person meeting of the Quad country leaders. Now, this is the grouping of the United States, so it'll be President Biden of the United States, Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison, Japanese Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga, and Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi. And they are going to talk about ongoing tightening of cooperation between their countries. Part of this is, as always, a pushback against what they see as China's growing assertiveness. But Sheila, tell us what we need to know about this upcoming group of talks.
Sure, happy to. So this is the second Quad meeting among leaders of these four countries this year. The first one was in February at the invitation of President Biden. It was a virtual meeting, though, not an in-person. So this is going to be a little different. The importance of the leaders meeting. Foreign ministers in the Quad have met previously, but this is a leaders meeting, which means you're bringing the entire set of resources of the government to the table and a considerable amount of strategic focus. So this is an important year for this particular coalition. Two things happened in February. The first was that all of the leaders expressed their concern about the last year or more of Chinese behavior. And this runs the gamut from human rights concerns to maritime behavior to economic coercion. And again, for your listeners, it's important to know that Australia in particular had a little bit of a showdown with China, in which China then imposed tariffs on Australia. So the economic security element is really prominent. What they did in February is they identified three areas that they would come together in working groups to decide how to cooperate. And very briefly, those three areas were in providing COVID vaccinations for the region, for the Indo-Pacific, for considering mechanisms and ways of enhancing economic resilience. And again, this is very much reflective of this vulnerability that everybody feels about sanctions from Beijing, but particularly focused on supply chains, supply chain resilience. And then the last bucket is a broader area of more future-oriented cooperation on technological innovation, getting out ahead of the 5G era into this next era of innovation. And the countries really want to think about ways in which they can collaborate on that.
So I remember back in February, especially the cooperation on COVID vaccines got a lot of attention, but we've just had this past week a huge amount of attention over the US-UK-Australia sub-deal. And this is, again, within the guise, I think, of expanding Quad cooperation as well. Can you talk a little bit about how that might figure in these talks too?
Sure. And this is important to see what we can expect coming out of this Friday's meeting. You know, these four countries are now pretty galvanized and they have a pretty broad set of concerns here when it comes to Chinese behavior. And as you mentioned, yes, the story of the week that is coming out in advance of this Quad is the new defense technology cooperation deal between Australia, United Kingdom, and the United States. This is important because Australia needs to modernize its submarines. It's had to address this problem over the last decade. In 2016, Australia signed a deal with France to upgrade its conventional subs. And again, as we know, Australia has conventional-based technology, submarine technology, and other kinds of weaponry. So this is important for two reasons. One, Australia said no thank you to the deal with France because it had not been producing the results Australia had expected. It's a different story. But on the Quad support or on the regional impact, this will give nuclear-powered technology for submarines to the Australians. And the only country, and of course that would be coming from the United States, that technology, and the only country that the United States has transferred that technology to in the past is the United Kingdom at the beginning of the Cold War, a long time ago. So this is revolutionary in a way because the United States is saying, okay, we are significantly worried about your capabilities, that we are willing to share this technology with you under all kinds of non-proliferation barriers, of course. All three powers were very clear to say this is not nuclear weapons. It is a specific technology and it will be in line with Australia's non-proliferation commitments, etc. But it will allow the Australian Navy to project power far, far greater distances from its shore. And therefore, in this coalition now of maritime security cooperation, this is a really important capability for the Australians to develop.
And from what I gather, this was welcomed in India as well, this announcement. What do you think is going to be the reaction of China to this Quad meeting? How are they going to regard this? What is sort of their reading of this gathering at this point?
The Chinese have basically used the language they have used consistently in response to the Quad, which is, this is old thinking. This is Cold War thinking. It's time that the United States particularly, but the United States and its allies, shift its thinking to be more reflective of the complex international relations of today. So there's a huge response in terms of the Quad writ large.
Right.
The deal, the Chinese have not been very happy. They have disparaged the UK's ambition in the Indo-Pacific, for example. The UK is not a member of the Quad, as you know, and they've disparaged the old Anglo-dominated alliance approach. So they're really hearkening back to a language that is very focused on, you know, the imperial era of 20th century history in Asia. So they have played that card as well, that this is not about the Indo-Pacific. This is about old Western Anglo cooperation being resurrected. So they've been quite damning. And of course, it can't make the Chinese happy, because this is a fairly significant shift for Australia. And it also puts Australia firmly on the side of the coalition partners, United States, Japan, India, of course, the Quad, but also others in Europe, UK, France are now becoming engaged on the same side, if you will, that is a side that's very concerned about maritime stability and security across the Indo-Pacific.
So one more thing I think is interesting is China then followed up and said, well, we'd like to join this large trade arrangement, the successor to the TPP, the CPTPP, with many countries in the region, including Japan, engaged. You know, it's anybody's guess, I guess, at this point, whether China actually gets into this, but it does indicate, you know, how they see a way of sort of growing their influence. I say that also because a lot of your initial comments, Sheila, were about the kind of trade ties among Quad countries. So can you talk a little bit about that? Is that something that could become a greater U.S. catalyst to trade in the region?
Sure. Well, you know, there's a couple of pieces here, Bob. And as you rightly pointed out, the CPTPP, which is the follow-on to the TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, that first the Bush administration, then the Obama administration was very supportive of, but the administration of Donald Trump, of course, decided the United States would withdraw from. So the partners in that, the other 11 countries, went on to form the CPTPP. It is a high standards trade agreement. It has labor standards embedded in it, environmental standards embedded in it. So it's very reflective of advanced economies right across the Pacific. Mm-hmm. China wants in, and there's been a healthy debate in China throughout the discussion of the TPP and now the CPTPP of whether this would be good for China, whether it would instigate reforms within the Chinese economy, whether it would help China make the kind of changes it really wanted to make in terms of opening up its economy. But I think the announcement today, or this week rather, was really a kind of a little bit of a response to the trilateral sub-deal. And I say that because many of the countries in Asia see the strategic future of the region as not necessarily being about military hardware, but really being about economic advancement and economic integration. And so China played the economic card, frankly. And it did it in a way, I think, that not only reflects Chinese long-term interests in the TPP or CPTPP now, but also reflects the instruments that China can bring to bear that the United States can't. And that's where I think the United States has really dropped a big ball in the region, because without its ability to move forward in trade liberalization, setting standards for trade, to opt out of that effort in the region is really seen across the region as America not playing with a full deck, if you will, in the region. Trade and investment are critical to the economic future of the region. So the United States needs to bring that to the table also. Interestingly, though, Bob, is we went from Australia deal to Chinese ask to enter CPTPP. The next day or two, we had Taiwan asking to join the CPTPP. So there is an awful lot of movement in the strategic checkerboard of Asia at the moment. And we'll see on Friday when we come out of the Quad, there's going to be some movement also on this economic resilience effort, which is supply chain diversification and strengthening access to supply chains to reduce vulnerability to Beijing. So there's an awful lot going on here. You know, we could talk about this 2 or 3 weeks from now, and the checkerboard might have changed just a little bit. But it's an exciting week to see how countries of the region are trying to counter each other, but also what the currency of power is across the Indo-Pacific.
Yeah, and safe to say Quad's going to be part of the conversation now quite a bit going forward on this Absolutely. Checkerboard.
It is. And so we will have a lot to talk about in the Indo-Pacific in the weeks going forward. But Bob, I wonder if we could turn our attention to an important election that's happening this weekend in Germany. So shift gears over to Europe. On Sunday, 60.4 million eligible voters in Germany will head to the polls, and they're going to choose their 20th Bundestag. That's the German parliament, and a new chancellor. So Chancellor Angela Merkel, who has led the Christian Democratic Union, is chancellor for 16 years, is stepping down, and she will not be on the ballot. What do we need to know going into this pivotal election in Germany?
Well, Sheila, first we should say the Merkel point is a big one, and maybe we get into a little bit of nuts and bolts about the German election process. Germans do not directly choose their chancellor. They choose from party lists, and the party heads typically emerge to help try to build coalitions, and they are then the chancellor. So Angela Merkel heads up a coalition currently actually that includes members of the CDU, her party, as well as the other major German party, the SPD. And then other parties are also part of the fold to create a critical mass of votes for major initiatives. So Germans are looking at this point, and the polling's been pretty steady, and you have this kind of razor-thin race going on between the SPD and the CDU. The SPD is leading by about 3 percentage points, which is basically a kind of a margin of error in polling. And then you have running a firm third is the Green Party. The Green Party had a moment of ascendance this past spring before it settled into third place. So we're going to have to see whether it's the CDU under Armin Laschet, who is a premier of the state of North Rhine-Westphalia. He's a well-known figure in the party. You have the SPD's Olaf Scholz, who's actually the current finance minister, and he's been vice chancellor as well. He's also a well-known figure. And then you have a bit of a political newcomer in the Green Party leader, Annalena Baerbock. The three of them have been holding debates. The consensus from the German reporting that I've seen is that Scholz has emerged as the leader in terms of on points, so to speak, in each case, just handling himself well, saying things that seem to be reassuring. The big takeaway at this point from what you're seeing in polling and comments from Germans is they are looking for reassurance. They're looking for a candidate who is going to guide Germany in the post-Merkel phase through all sorts of treacherous waters. The post-COVID period, a period of supply chain disruptions and continental ferment involving still strong populist parties in Europe, Russia and its sort of, you know, assertiveness on the eastern frontier of Europe, as well as bringing home a deal with Russia on the Nord Stream natural gas pipeline. Somebody who's going to bring home all of these issues and maintain Germany's place. It's the world's fourth largest economy. It's the largest in Europe. It is a heavyweight in lots of ways. And most recently, it's been seen as a kind of a standard bearer of the quote unquote, you know, liberal democratic order. And so you have in the post-Merkel period, a lot of questions, and it's going to be a kind of a litmus test on what the Germans see as what is the reassuring candidate, and then what kind of sort of coalition is going to emerge from that.
So Bobby, you know, I can't imagine the EU without Merkel. She's just been such a, not only as a leader and the sort of the mother, as she's called, of German politics, but she's also been such an anchor for the EU. And as you pointed out, there's so many issues, whether it's the future of the economy, the economic performance of the EU, the balancing act with Russia, but also the EU has begun to shift, right? So you've got Brexit, you've got the UK exiting, you've got now a little bit of a strategic spat between the United States and France. And German-French relations are going to be a critical piece of the future of the EU. Any thoughts there on what this election might mean for those dynamics?
It's a really good point. I think you have France emerging as an even stronger country. You have President Macron, who is going to be seen, at least initially, as kind of one of the giant figures striding Europe. And both countries have been reaching out to each other to kind of strengthen their bonds as the essential partners in sort of bringing Europe through all sorts of difficulties, including, as you mentioned, the post-Brexit order. I think that's going to be very important. I think you've got a number of important things coming up, including the November 1st kickoff of the summit in Glasgow, Scotland, of the climate summit, and what's going to emerge from that. Climate, you can't stress enough the importance of climate as an issue in a number of elections. It seemed to be a crucial point for Norway's recent elections, although it was not Norway's Greens, but Norway's Labour Party that surged into victory from that. In Germany, it's a bit more nuanced. You have all the major parties that I mentioned are basically coalesce around climate. First of all, around acknowledging human-caused climate change and the need for strong policies to limit carbon emissions. The Greens, unsurprisingly, want to go further, faster. That worries some, but the Greens could be expected to be in any sort of governing coalition, so they're going to have a role, I think it's safe to say, in a new German government. I think it's that question of German sense of stability. You cannot stress enough how important that is to Germans, and the pace at which German policies change to accommodate aggressive climate targets, because I think Germany wants to make a statement. They want to show they're in a leadership role. They don't want to mortgage their future, though, at the same time, and maybe take steps that will create some real unease, whether it's, you know, ambitious spending targets, whether it's ambitious cuts to carbon emissions and sort of opening up an unknown chapter for say, energy sources. It's going to be a very interesting sort of calculus that the Germans pursue there, Sheila. And I think they are going to be seeking partnership with the EU. It's also worth noting there is a German national, Ursula von der Leyen, who's a European Commission president, who has been also speaking out very strongly and speaking out on support of France and French ties, a big statement of support after the US-UK-Australia subdeal was announced. So there's all these types of things going on as well within the continent. I'll just add that, again, the three major candidates I mentioned are all very much strong pro-EU supporters. There's no sort of waffling. going on that issue.
That's great. And of course, we have an election coming up to pay attention to in France, too, as well. So Europe is on the move as much as the Indo-Pacific is, right?
Absolutely is, Sheila. And it's an incredible election-packed fall, and as you say, going into next year as well. But we got some leadership things to talk about back in the neck of the woods that you follow closely, Sheila, and that's in Japan. In the coming week, Japan's Liberal Democratic Party, the dominant political party, is set to hold leadership elections on September 29th. The winner of those elections is going to become Japan's new prime minister and head the party in the general election, which is scheduled for November. So, Sheila, with that sort of playing out, what are we looking at in terms of the stakes for these upcoming elections?
So this is an exciting time to be watching Japanese politics, and especially, I'll try not to go too much in the weeds, but for most of us Japan watchers, there's an awful lot of weeds to go through. But, you know, as you noted, the LDP, the Liberal Democratic Party leader, does go on to become prime minister because the LDP has had a dominant role in the Japanese Diet, which is the Japanese parliament. So again, we're looking at parliamentary dynamics here in Japan as well. So the leadership election, as you noted, is on the 29th. This is the largest party. It claims about anywhere between 35 to 40% of Japanese voters' loyalty, but it is not met by a strong opposition, right? So this is a party that has largely dominated Japanese politics for decades, even with small coalition partners. What was stunning and what led us to this, of course, was that Prime Minister Suga decided not to run. And that's where all of us Japan watchers were a little taken aback. Your listeners may remember that Prime Minister Suga stepped in an unusual leadership election when Prime Minister Abe stepped down last August. So there was a provisional election where Suga would then carry out the last year of Mr. Abe's three-year term. Everybody expected him to run for his own three-year term going forward, but his public approval rating had plunged because of COVID management questions, the Olympics, and it never really returned. He was in the 30 percentile, depending on which newspaper, high 30s, mid 30s, right? It was not a good moment for Mr. Suga. And he did not garner the party support that he expected. When he had been elected last year, he had the support not only of Prime Minister Abe, but also of another large, significant faction leader, Mr. Aso Taro, who is the deputy prime minister. And basically, he was told that the younger LDP members were not rallying around him as a choice. And so he withdrew. So that opened the stage, stunning announcement, but that opened the way for a pretty contentious race, an interesting race. Again, we've got four contenders. I'll run through them really quickly, not in detail, but Kishida Fumio is former foreign minister for Prime Minister Abe. Kono Taro is currently in charge of the vaccination rollout for COVID in the Suga cabinet. Takaichi Sanai is a former minister of internal affairs, but she has distinguished herself for her arguments on the right, which is constitutional revision, increased defense spending. And then we have Noda Seiko, who's been a longtime stalwart within the LDP, a longtime more liberal, social policy-oriented leader, also a cabinet minister. So two men, two women, again, unusual for Japan. Their ages go from 58 at the youngest, which is Kono, to 64 for the oldest. So this is, you know, in Japanese terms, this is a young group. This is the next generation face that's coming forward for the LDP. So in that sense, it's fascinating to watch. They're in the middle of the campaign, opened formally the 17th. And as you said, the first round of elections will be on the 29th. Now, the important thing is, you know, there are two sets of voters who can weigh in on this choice. One are the already elected legislators in the Japanese Diet, upper or lower house. And that's where all the factional dynamics come to play. And the second is the rank and file of the LDP. And they have equal numbers of votes. There'll be a total of 766 votes cast on the 29th. And so the question is, will one person emerge with a majority? If they do, they take it. If they don't, then there'll be a whole host of machinations and reorganization between who's in the first and second category versus the third and fourth, right? It'll be a little bit of there'll be a second round and possibly even a third round in which the rank and file members of the party don't get as much of a voice. So interesting future for the LDP. And on October 4th is the date, I think, that's been set now for the vote in the parliament that would then convey the imprimatur of the legislature on the selection of the party for prime ministership. So stay tuned. And as you noted, there's a big, big election coming down the pike a month from now.
So Sheila, a question comes to mind because we started out the podcast talking about the Quad. And we've mentioned in the past, and Jim and I have talked any number of times about how foreign policy doesn't really tend to matter for the U.S. Yeah. elections. And I'm just kind of curious about the extent to which so many of the things going on matter as this potentially new generation of Japanese leaders is chosen, you know, not just the Quad, but, you know, you've got North Korea testing out all sorts of new scary technology, seemingly. You have, you know, again, China's assertiveness that you were talking about, and potentially even vis-a-vis Taiwan and what that involves. You have the, you know, global efforts to get involved in a COVID response and all sorts of other things. Are you seeing any sort of through line between between any of the epic international things going on and this very sort of domestic process that Japan's going through?
Absolutely. So there's four debates for the LDP candidates, right? The four candidates. And defense is in every debate. The relationship with China is in every debate. There's been a little bit more sporadic questioning about North Korea because, of course, North Korea has been a little quiet of late, despite, you know, a couple weekends ago. But really, this is a focus on how do you feel about Japan's defenses? What does Japan need to do? And, you know, Kishida Fumio is a former foreign minister who has been very effective in diplomacy with China. Even he's coming out in a little bit more strong way of saying we have China as our biggest strategic challenge. We need to think about our military capabilities. So you've got across the board now a much more focused set of questions for leaders in the LDP, Conservative Party, to be sure, about Japan's own military options and Japan's own readiness to deal with the strategic dynamics of the Indo-Pacific.
Interesting. Okay. So I guess we have the kickoff of a whole bunch of interesting Japanese political developments to look for.
We do. It'll be a busy fall, but I think it's time for us to discuss our audience figure of the week, which listeners can vote on or tweet us at CFR_org. This week, Bob, our audience selected Haitian migrants returned. Why did our audience select this?
Well, it's first of all worth noting, Sheila, that this issue seemed to come out of nowhere. And not that Haiti's not been in the news. Haiti certainly has. And for all the wrong reasons, unfortunately, it's had a political assassination to deal with of its leader. That's still playing out, followed by another powerful earthquake hitting in many of its rural areas, just absolutely leveling parts of the country. The migrants that are mentioned in our audience figure are actually, many of them, migrants from a previous earthquake, the epic 2010 earthquake that leveled the capital, Port-au-Prince, and other areas. And the figure that has been attached to this now, from what I've seen, is estimated that up to 15,000 Haitian migrants appeared at this U.S. border area with Mexico, the Del Rio area. These are Haitians who were living in other Central and South American countries, everywhere from Guatemala to Chile, and by many accounts had, over time, over recent time, had become encouraged, seemingly, at least many of them had, and maybe they were chattering amongst themselves, by an announcement back in the late spring by the U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas that an 18-month temporary protective status for Haitians already residing in the U.S. would be applied as of midsummer. And there was a sense that this was something that could be expanded to other Haitians who were in and around the hemisphere, and that there's many Haitians who already live in the United States. Many of these people have family in the U.S. There are huge Haitian populations in places like Florida and New York City, for example. And so it all kind of coalesced and they started crossing the border. And these border issues have plagued multiple administrations. It's been a challenge for every administration, really, this century. But the Trump administration came into office as one of its big issues, and it was challenged. And it sought a number of tough measures to counter it, but was also challenged. The Biden administration is facing a particular set of challenges. Its response to this latest set of migrant issues has basically generated flak from all sides. It seemed to be completely unprepared for it. Its initial response, some of which was captured virally, showed agents on horseback trying to round up Haitians, really sending awful signals about how it was treating people who were seeking asylum in the U.S. and who had been coming for a whole host of reasons, including security concerns, human rights abuses, severe poverty, and so forth, and yet were seen as being rounded up on horseback. Some were rounded up and put on planes and sent back to Haiti, a country they hadn't been to, their native country they hadn't been back to in about 10 years for some of them, anti-COVID-19 protocols in place by the Trump administration. The latest reports are that, no, in fact, many more, potentially in the thousands, are actually being released and allowed to come into the country, into the U.S., to await hearings on their applications. And that has generated all sorts of, various of these responses have generated concern and harsh criticism from Republicans in the United States and from Texas politicians and so forth. On top of everything else, as we were coming into the podcast today, Sheila, this U.S. Special Envoy for Haiti, Ambassador Daniel Foote, resigned, you know, amidst these policy changes and the reactions. So the U.S. is facing yet another unexpected border crisis, really.
It was such a surprise to me as somebody who's not an expert in the region or in immigration to the United States, but it was such a surprise to me to see these families who had been outside of Haiti for such a long period of time. In fact, children born in many South and Central American countries, as you pointed out. But it does reflect the complexity of migration today. It's not, we get very focused on the border and the particular trans-border movements, but in fact, these are people coming from all different kinds of situations and countries. So very complex for our policymakers.
Yeah, and you have had Vice President Kamala Harris involved, focused primarily so far on the sort of so-called Northern Triangle countries of Central America, which have been a main source of many migrants coming because those three countries, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, have had so many problems. And this renewed emphasis emphasis on trying to bolster those countries economically, security-wise, and so forth, so that people are not compelled to leave. Haiti, the U.S. also has a presence. It's been trying to help Haiti respond to so many sort of levels of crisis, but it's going to involve a combination of things. As we've talked about before, there's no easy answers, but it seems like, you know, this, you know, redoubled effort to help the origin countries stand up better on their own, and then come up with interim, and by interim, maybe things that are involving a couple of years, interim steps that can allow for the humane treatment of people who are desperately, you know, seeking to cross or have already crossed into the U.S., and treating them humanely, trying to process asylum requests, and also just sort of deal with population control in a way that is somehow orderly. It all involves resources, massive planning, and it's an absolute political sort of toxic issue right now.
It is. It's very difficult and very difficult to watch, but I'm sure we'll continue to have to focus on the Haitian migrant crisis, because it's not, there's no easy solution that I can see. So I think that's our look at the world this week, Bob. Thank you. There are some other stories to keep an eye on, though. The North Korean Supreme People's Assembly meets in Pyongyang, and the United Nations Security Council marks the 25th anniversary of the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. So there's lots going on in the world to follow.
Never a shortage of World Next Week topics, Sheila. And please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And leave us a review if you can. They really help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed on The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Zoe Collis, with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe also doubled as our recording engineer. Thanks, Zoe. Special thanks to Erin Gallagher for her assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons.
This is Sheila Smith saying goodbye.
This is Bob McMahon saying thanks so much, Sheila, for joining the show this week, and take care, everyone.